And now a conversation about something we encounter each and every day, but perhaps pay attention to only subconsciously. When you compose a document on your computer, how much time do you spend deciding what typeface to use? Do you use different styles for different kinds of documents? Would you use the same font for a job application that you'd use in a love letter? Do you think you'd respond to certain ads or web pages because the typeface they employ catches your attention in a particular way? Well, in a new book on that subject, edited by one of my guests this morning, Christopher Clark writes, "Digital typography now teems with the diversity of a tropical rainforest, and it's littered with more trash than an urban underpass." And to help walk us through the process of designing typefaces and to help us understand why some work well and others do not, we turn to Ellen Lupton and Tal Lemming. Ellen is the director of the Graphic Design MFA program at the Maryland Institute College of Art and the curator of contemporary design at the Cooper Hewitt National Design Museum in New York City. She's also the editor of a new book called Type on Screen, a critical guide for designers, writers, developers, and students. Tal Lemming is a designer based in Baltimore at his type foundry called Type Supply. His lettering can be found on boxes of Quaker Oats, the Hollywood Reporter, Money Magazine, and Good Housekeeping, among other places. And along with MICA faculty member Abbott Miller, they'll be hosting an event tonight called Type Night at MICA. And they join me in the studio. Good morning to you both. Good to see you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Ellen, you write in this book that visual anatomy and cultural geography is important for typography. What does that mean?
Well, really, every typeface we use is based in history, even if it's a brand new typeface. So there are typefaces that really reach back to the Renaissance or to the 1950s or to the 60s, to pop art. And when designers choose typefaces, they're always thinking about that kind of prehistory of the font, not just its current use.
And when you're analyzing a typeface, you talk about the visual anatomy. What are the elements of... What's the anatomical elements of the letter A?
Well, typefaces have ascenders and descenders. An A can have like a single ball or be a double kind of story, like the Helvetica A, which has that teardrop shape in it. And those shapes are distinctive to every typeface. And we come to recognize them and love them.
And your book is called Type on Screen. So what is the what are the elements or the calculations that a type designer needs to make when she's designing for the screen as opposed to a newspaper or a magazine or a banner flying behind an airplane? I mean, Tal, how does one go about figuring out how the type is going to work in different situations?
Well, you typically want to think about where it's going to be used primarily, and you'll think about the reading distance and the environmental factors, you know, the lighting that's going to be around it. For example, if you are designing a typeface for a sign, you want to know if it's backlit or frontlit, or if you're designing something for a book, how's it going to be printed, what kind of press, what kind of ink. So those are the kinds of things that you have to think about.
What are the criteria that you use, Tal, to decide whether a type design is great and it works or is rotten and it doesn't work?
If people use it, because that's ultimately what it is supposed to be. It's a tool. It's not an end product in itself. If I make an A that's just really pretty, it's just an A. But if I make a system where the A works with the B and the C and everything else, and that finds functionality and makes design possible, then that's what makes it successful.
And Ellen, in the book, you've got a rating system, actually, and then you give us a whole bunch of different examples of typeface, and you rate them by legibility, readability, flexibility, showmanship, I like that one, classiness, and amphibiousness. All right, so let's talk about the last two, since I have no idea what you're talking about. I mean, I have a notion of classiness, but what does that mean? What makes a typeface classy?
Well, it's sophistication. Does the typeface have a kind of formality and gravitas for it? Designers love to hate Comic Sans, even though it's not such a bad typeface, but it certainly isn't classy, whereas a typeface like Minion or Garamond or maybe even Times New Roman has a bit of class to it.
The question you ask in your book is, would you take it to the Red Lobster or would you buy it a diamond ring? Hmm. I've never thought about the letters in my books in those terms. How about amphibiousness? What does
well,
that
that's
mean?
Really, does a typeface move well from the printed page to the screen? And big companies need to have typefaces that work in every medium. They need to look good on the web. They have to look good in print. And an amphibious typeface is able to swim and breathe the air and do all those things.
Okay, so they can exist in all sorts of different environments. So Tal, the screen, Ellen writes in this book that the screen is a flickering and ephemeral world. And there are a lot of people who manipulate the type that they encounter on the screen when they use it themselves. If they copy an article or they copy a page out of a website, they'll put it in an Evernote thing, or you know, they'll store it digitally, or they'll put it someplace else, and even change the typeface. What does that mean for the designer? I mean, you don't have ultimate control over it in those circumstances, do you?
Yeah, once typefaces became digital, we lost a lot of control, and so there's almost a generational thing among type designers. My generation was sort of the first to experience things digitally, and so we have more of a people are going to do what they're going to do with it. And so, you know, on the computer, you can squeeze type and make it more narrow or wider. And that's something we didn't draw for that. If we wanted it to be wider, we would have made it wider. But there's a certain level of acceptance that we just have to have about the way things are going to be changed on screen.
And do you design with that in mind? I mean, do you design it with a certain amount of flexibility then so it can work, you know, whether it's squeezed tight or spread wide, something like that?
Yeah. As we think about the space between the letters becoming tighter or looser, changing the actual letter forms to make them more narrow or wider is a harder thing to design for. And I know there are a few typefaces that have been designed to try to accommodate that, but they haven't worked that well.
Sure, of course. Tal Lemming is a typeface designer based here in Baltimore. Ellen Lupton is a designer, a writer, a curator, and a critic on the faculty of the Maryland Institute College of Art. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast on 88.1 WYPR. So Ellen, in the book, Type on Screen, you talk about orbital content. And you bring up an interesting notion, which is that sometimes readers of typefaces are not human. There are computers and robots scanning these things. How does that affect, first of all, what is orbital content, and how does it affect the fact, how does the fact that not all humans are reading this
right.
affect how you design it?
Well, this is the idea that now we all collect our own content. The content revolves around us. So it used to be that you went, you know, to the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal to do your reading, but now we have feeds and we collect things and we're emailed, and then we save it to programs like Evernote or Reddit, you know, these reading programs where you can change it and make it your own, and in a sense you kind of rebrand it and possess it, and that's what that's all about. And of course, type has to be read by all kinds of spiders and search bots that are out there looking for information. And so it's important then that everything be in a real font that can actually be read and collected and gathered.
Yeah, I was interested in an app and a program that I learned about in the book called Readability that you can sign up in. It'll take all this stuff that you grab off the web and make it all in the same typeface.
And strip away the ads.
Yeah.
And it really becomes yours then, and not so much a corporate product, but something that you own because you read it and collected it.
Yeah, and it must be the bane of the existence of all those people selling space on websites. So Tal, as I understand it, you're currently developing a couple of new typefaces. One is called Baltimore and the other Timonium. Do I have that right?
Yeah, Timonium is one that I released several years ago, and Balto is one that I released about a year ago.
So talk me through the process of designing a new typeface. I mean, did you sit down and think of the title first, or did you design a typeface and say, oh, I'm going to call this Balto?
Naming the typeface may be the hardest part of the process. In my case, I like to name my typefaces with either a word that I think is funny or with something that has some significance to me in my life at the moment that I designed that typeface. In the case of Timonium, I had just become a dad, and I was driving to the grocery store a lot through Timonium, and Timonium is just a great word, so that became the name of a typeface. And Balto, when my wife and I moved to Baltimore, I just got this idea for a typeface and worked on it, and I wanted to name it after the place where we live, and Baltimore was too long. And I noticed the old abbreviation Balto and just loved it.
And so is there any artistic inspiration that is derived from Baltimore or Timonium in particular, or are they just names?
They're names, but in the case of Balto, there was a certain environmental influence. It's not hard. It's not easy to pin down, oh, I drew the A because it reminds me of Fells Point or anything like that. But there's a certain environmental feeling that influenced the design of the typeface.
Well, this is fascinating stuff, and I think you guys are going to have a great time tonight at Type Night. So thanks to you both for coming by. Appreciate it. And Tal Lemming designs type at his personal type foundry, Type Supply, here in Baltimore. Ellen Lupton is the director of the graphic design MFA program at the Maryland Institute College of Art and the editor of a new book called Type on Screen, a critical guide for designers, writers, developers, and students. It's published by Princeton Architectural Press, and you can check it out tonight, as I said, at the Maryland Institute College of Art, where Ellen and Tal, along with MICA faculty member Abbott Miller, he's also written a new book. They'll all host an event tonight called Type Night. It's free. It's open to the public. Starts at 6:30 in Falvey Hall at the Brown Center on Mount Royal Avenue in Baltimore. Come on over to wipr.org/Maryland Morning. For more information. Maryland Morning is an original production of Your Public Radio, WIPR, in Baltimore. We've got production help from Payam Agagasam and Elizabeth Sherwood. We're produced by Matt Purdy and Jamila Kay. We're directed by Nathan Sterner, who also presses all the buttons in the control room, and he knows a lot about pressing buttons. If you come to our website, wipr.org/Maryland Morning, it won't be like going to the Oprah Winfrey Show a few years ago. You will not get a free car, but we promise you will get the chance to leave a comment about something you've heard or hear any shows that you might have missed. That's it for us today. We'll see you on Wednesday when Brian Stelter from CNN talks about the big business of morning TV, and radio host Martin Goldsmith talks about his poignant memoir, Alex's Wake. Hope you can join us Wednesday morning for Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. For Sheila and Nathan, I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.